Matthew chapter 5. Let's turn there together. Matthew chapter 5. We just got into this chapter last week. We looked at the Beatitudes. Remember, the attitude that we were to have. Jesus is laying out the kingdom way for the people here. And in fact, he's showing them really, here's the way to the king. This is really the Beatitudes we looked at, really the way that people kind of come into a realization that they need a Savior. These are kind of the steps that they would go through. And Jesus is laying out the attitudes. Again, it's not the do attitudes. It's not the I'll try attitudes. This is the Beatitudes. This is a way that we are to be. Christianity is not about doing. It's not about trying to follow something. Christianity is about an attitude that we are to have, the way that we are to live. This is the kingdom way that Jesus is laying down for his disciples as he gathered them together there on the mountainside. And we saw again the way to the king. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You see, when we begin to get a true understanding of Jesus Christ, when we begin to get some insight of him, we're going to realize, wow, we are poor in spirit. There is a poverty about us. There's nothing in us that makes us right before God. There's nothing in ourselves that can commend us before God. We're poor in spirit. We realize, wow, I've got nothing. I've got nothing to make me right with God. And then blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. We realize we're sinners. My righteousness is as filthy rags. I've got nothing. Sin has kept me from God, and we mourn. We're troubled over that. We're mourning. Ah, but blessed are those that mourn, for they shall be comforted. And then he says, blessed are the meek. Remember that word meek. Just break it down. Me, ek. We realize I'm nothing. I'm nothing in myself. There's nothing good about me. Me? Ah, yuck. And again, that word meekness is not speaking about weakness. It's about having a power in control, strength in control. You see, the world says if you want something, man, you've got to rise up and take it. You've got to go for it, man. You've got to be strong and assertive and make it happen. But Jesus says, blessed are the meek, because it's those people that shall inherit the earth. Not those that say, we've got to assert ourselves, we've got to take control, we've got to go forward. No, blessed are the meek. Strength in control. Just being gentle. Jesus himself said that I am meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. And so we've seen that there's been an emptying of ourselves. We're poor in spirit. There's nothing in ourselves. We're mourning over sin. Me? Yuck. Ah, no. There's nothing good about me. We've emptied ourselves, so now we need to be filled. And he says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Not filling ourselves with things that don't matter, but filling ourselves with his righteousness. We come to Jesus and say, it's only through you that I can have a right standing before God. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. You begin to feel, oh, Lord, you're doing a good work in me. It's you, your life in my life, that's beginning to fill me. And then blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. You see, seeing our error will help in being merciful. It's so easy for us to look at others now after we've been coming to Lord and being filled, to look at others and go, oh, look at those people. They're messing up. Man, they're sinners. Look at those guys. Oh, Lord, how can you stand them? And yet we realize, man, that was me. It's the same place I was in. I got to show mercy on those guys. Because if it wasn't for the Lord's mercy, I wouldn't be standing here. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. We've already obtained mercy. Let us now show mercy upon others. And blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. That's a good one. Man, that's been on my mind this week. Blessed are the pure in heart. You see, when we come to Christ, he cleanses us. He forgives us of our sin. He empties us of sin in the sense that sin no longer has any power over us. We're a new creation in him. But yet it's still easy for us as believers, as those forgiven, to allow various things to come into our lives that pollute us. And you see, when we allow those things to come into our lives that pollute us, it will keep us from seeing God clearly. And it can be a number of things. What are those things that you find yourselves passionate about? If it's not of the Lord, it's going to keep you from seeing God. Blessed are the pure in heart. In other words, you're removing all of that junk in your life that gets in the way, that tends to pollute us, that weighs us down, that keeps us from seeing God clearly. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And then he says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Man, we get to be peacemakers now. We've come to the Lord and we've experienced his righteousness, his goodness, his mercy. We're beginning to see him more clearly. Now we want to bring others to him. We want to bring others to the Prince of Peace. We want to be peacemakers, shining the light forth and bringing peace into people's lives. How are people going to find peace? It's only through Jesus Christ. He is the Prince of Peace. And it's only in him that people will truly find peace. And so we want to go out in the world and say, hey, let me tell you about Jesus. How he's enriched my life, how he's blessed me so abundantly. Let me share that good news with you. And man, we bring people and show them Jesus and they can come into the family of God. They themselves can be called sons of God. Blessed are the peacemakers. They shall be called sons of God. Now, of course, those kinds of people saying, it's not about me. I'm emptying myself. I want to be filled with Jesus Christ. I want to go out and just serve him. Of course, the world is just looking for people like that to embrace, aren't they? The world is saying, man, that's the kind of people I want to hang out with. Oh, if only that were so. Because then Jesus says, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's a shock. Could you imagine the disciples sitting there going, yeah, this is good, Lord. What a great teaching. Empty myself. Yeah, I need to come to you. I've got nothing in myself to make me in a right standing with God. Lord, may I experience your mercy, your righteousness, your goodness. That's great, Lord. Thank you. And he says, blessed are the persecuted. And the disciples must have just, what? Come on. Persecuted? Are you kidding me? When we're living this kind of life, won't the world just rally around us and say, hey, man, you're the kind of people I want to hang out with. No, Jesus says you're going to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. When you're living this life, when you're following this kingdom way, expect persecution. Expect persecution. And we ended last week with that promise that Paul showed us in Timothy. All those that desire to live godly will be persecuted. All those that desire to live godly lives will be persecuted. Wow. And so as I'm living my life, man, that's a good measuring stick for me to realize if I'm following this kingdom way, if I'm living my life truly for the Lord, I can expect persecution. I don't need to run from it. I don't need to say, Lord, what are you doing to me? I can sit there and go, praise God, I guess I must be doing something right. Persecution will come. Blessed are you when you're persecuted for righteousness' sake. And then in verse 13, we'll pick it up where we left off last week. Verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. What does salt do? Salt does a lot of things. You know, first of all, just in connection to what we're seeing about persecution, you know, salt can be a real irritant. Have you ever had a cut? Have you ever gone into the ocean? Man, that salt just stings, doesn't it? In fact, that used to be forms of torture. They would, you know, whip people's back and then they'd pour salt on their back because it would get in their cuts and it would just sting. It would hurt. It would be painful. And you see, as we go in the world and we're being salt of the earth, we understand that there are those, they're wounded. and they're hurting. And sometimes that salt gets in and it can be an irritant. Sometimes people are going to lash out at you, and that's the persecution we see. People see the salt and it gets in those cuts, in those afflictions that they have, and they go, man, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to know that. That hurts me right now. And it can be a real irritant. And that can be where persecution stems from. But we also see that salt has a great healing agent to it. You ever had a sore throat, you know, or something wrong with the tonsils and the doctor? Just gargle with salt water. Gargle with salt water. It's not pleasant. In fact, man, I've tried that and I just gag. I can't stand it. And yet it has a neat healing property to it. People that have had cuts have gone and soaked in the ocean and found that their wounds have just healed up quickly. And so it is. There are those that will respond in a harsh way, but there are those that will realize, wow, that salt is doing something in my life. That's bringing healing into my life. It's beginning to kind of help. I like that. Salt adds flavor. I love barbecuing. Barbecuing is good, isn't it? Throw a big steak on there or a hamburger. And you know, man, when you salt that thing up, oh, that's good. That's scrumptious. I like it. I'm sure that's a killer for you right now as you're anticipating lunch. I shouldn't be talking about food right now. But as people find out what a blessing salt can be, they will be attracted to it. It brings flavor in their lives. They go, wow, that's good. That's adding some richness to my life. And as we, as believers, go out and be salt of the earth and we begin to show that saltiness into the world, there are people that will be attracted to it and go, man, that's bringing some richness into my life. That's adding flavor. There's something good about what you are talking about, what you're doing, how you're living. It's a blessing. But you see, you also know that when you salt something and you eat something salty, it begins to promote a thirst, doesn't it? It begins to make you thirsty. And so it is, as we live salty lives, it will create a thirst in others for what we have. That's the blessed life. That's the life in Jesus Christ, the life of peace, the life of joy, the life of happiness. That's what the Beatitudes is. It's the happy way, the kingdom way. It'll promote a thirst. But there's another thing that salt does that was used primarily in this day that we don't use as much today in the age of refrigeration. But salt was used as a preservative. You see, when they would take their meat and pack it up, they didn't have a nice fridge. They didn't have a nice electric cooler like we have in the back for a dad's root beer. They didn't have anything like that. And so they would go and salt their meats and salt those things because it would prevent decay. It would prevent rotting from happening in those meats and in those things that would perhaps begin to putrefy. And so it is that Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. In other words, we are to be those that are going out into our world, in our society, and preventing or arresting decay in our culture and society. You see, we can see quite plainly our day quickly going downhill. And things being accepted that years ago would have been frowned upon. And we wonder, what's happened? And we can't ask, we can't say, we can't question, what have they done to go so far down? We need to ask, what have we done to stop being salt in this world? Because that's what Jesus' intent was. Be salt of the earth so that you will preserve that which is godly in our nation, in our word, in our world. Preserving that which has a Christian basis. Our very society, our very country was built upon, based upon Christian precepts. And yet how far we've gone. And the question needs to be asked, are we being those that are being salt in the earth, standing up for these things? Not going out and being weird and fanatical and carrying signs around saying, you know, no, we got to, but just really going out and being the salt of the earth, where we're preserving that which is godly in our world. Because we see how far society has come. You know, and the whole gay marriage thing, that's a huge one right now. And there are a lot of Christians that are just content to say, well, you know, that's the world for you. But we need to be those that are standing up and saying, hey, we're not going to just roll over here. We're not just going to, you know, just step aside and say, well, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. We need to be those that are saying, no, this is not what God's desire is. And we need to be salt. We need to be preserving that which is godly, that which is good, that which is Christian in our world. We need to be careful that we are being those that take a stand on those things. For Jesus says, if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned again? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Guys, let's not be those that lose our saltiness. Because Jesus says, how then shall it be seasoned again? And there are many things that have gone to the place now where there's no turning back. But those things that are trying to be enforced and pushed in, man, let's stand up as believers in the Lord and say, hey, that's not good. That's only going to corrupt society. That's only going to degrade our culture all the more. Let's be that salt. Let's take a stand. And let's not be those that are good for nothing as Christians, where we're just stepping aside and being trampled on by the world. Let's take a stand. And then he says, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. But it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. What a proclamation this would have been, because Jesus will later say in John chapter 8, verse 12, I am the light of the world. But now he says to his disciples, you are the light of the world. It's a heavy responsibility. It's a heavy responsibility for us. As Jesus was the light of the world, so are we too to be light in this world. Don't hide it. You see, the very purpose of light is to reveal or illuminate darkness, to dispel darkness. That's what light is to do. And we need to be shining forth our light, the light of Jesus Christ, that we begin to illuminate into the world and illuminate into people's lives the place of darkness that they find themselves in. A lot of people will never understand the dark place that they find themselves in until the light exposes it. Again, don't be quick to just kind of come alongside people and say, hey, everything's fine, man. You're okay. Where we kind of hide our light and say, I don't want them to think that, you know, I'm some Jesus freak. I'm just going to kind of hide my light a bit. I'm going to kind of maybe shoot my light that way, but I won't really, you know, shine it in his life because, I don't want any kind of controversy here. They're never going to know the darkness they're in until the light begins to shine forth and illuminate to them their darkness. And that, and thus it is in the world too. Jesus says, go and shine your light. A city that's set upon a hill. Man, that light goes forth. It can't help but to shine forth. Nor do you take your light or light a lamp and put it under a basket, but you put it on a lampstand. In other words, when you put it up on a lampstand, it begins to illuminate a much greater area. And that's what we're to do. Guys, let your light so shine. Put it up high where people can see it. Put it up high where it will have a greater radius of effect. Don't be quick to say, man, I'm just kind of, you know, wanting to get by in the world. I'm just trying to fit in. I'm just going to try to go under the radar here. I'm just going to kind of keep my light shining maybe just in my feet, and that's it. Illuminate my path, and that's all. No, put it up high that people will see, and that people will begin to see the darkness around them. Be those that are shining your light. But here's the key. In verse 16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. there are a lot of people that love to shine their light so they can be seen. You know, where you take a flashlight and you shine it on your face. Hey, everybody, look at me. I'm going to make some funny face. You know, and you campfire, you put your light up to your face. And a lot of people are looking to shine their light so that they are the ones that are seen. I'm so impressed, so amazed that whenever Jesus went and did a miracle, when he was blessing people, what happened? They didn't sit there and say, oh, Jesus, thank you so much. Can I get a picture with you? Can we come along, get everybody gather around? Hey, Jesus, man, touch my life. And they're looking to get, they're not looking to kind of promote Jesus. They're not looking to say, hey, can we just get a story on you, put it on the front page of the Jerusalem Post or something? This is exciting what you're doing. That's not what they did. When Jesus touched a life, when a person's life was healed, they went away praising and glorifying the Father. You see, Jesus was able to work and minister in a way that his light was shining forth, but so that his heavenly Father was the one receiving the glory. Man, that impresses me. Because that's something I think that our human tendencies really struggle with. Our human nature finds it hard to say, I don't want to be seen. You know, we love to do those things where we can be, you know, front and center. Where we're the ones that are getting the credit or the glory, you know. Hey, did you hear what I did the other day? Man, I came and I did some stuff for the church, and oh, it's just great, man. And oh, it's just real blessing, and God really did some neat things. But boy, it's just, you know, it was just a really neat thing that I was able to do. And we can kind of talk about those things and kind of bring the attention to us. Guys, we need to be letting our light shine so that our Father in heaven gets all the glory, all the credit. Let your light so shine. Yeah, that they might see your good works, but so that they will turn and say, praise you, God. All glory and all praise be given to you, God. You're the one that needs to be praised in that. It's an old Puritan that once said, the light of the stars dissipate when the sun comes up. The light of the stars dissipate when the sun comes up. And so it is when we're looking to serve Jesus, when he's the one that we're looking to see, man, may our lights be off of ourselves and just be upon Jesus. May the Son of God be the one that's seen in all that we do and not ourselves. And notice Jesus says here, I like this, that you are the salt, you are the light. He doesn't say, you know, with a little bit of training, with a little bit of discipleship, I think we might have something here. I think we might be on the right track. With a little bit of effort, just a little bit of real instruction, I think we can do something here. He says, you are the light. You are the salt. Guys, this is not something that we need to try to achieve to be. This is something that Jesus says we are. We're either fulfilling it or we're failing in that responsibility. And I pray that we'd all be those that are being faithful and fulfilling that responsibility of being salt and being light in the world. It's not something you need to pray and say, Lord, help me, train me. No, again, that be attitude, this is the way that we are to be. You are the salt. When we have Jesus in us, we are going to be the light. We are going to be the salt. Verse 17, do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Jesus never said the law was now officially void or defunct. He wasn't here to bring an end to the law. He came to accomplish it. He came to fulfill it perfectly. The law was actually established through him. You see, the law for such a long time was being abused. It was being misunderstood, really. The Pharisees and the scribes, they were looking to follow it to the minutest detail. And along with that, they added their interpretations and their traditions to it, that it became an exhausting list of rules and regulations to follow. They formed, out of the oral law, the scribes' tradition, they formed the Mishnah. In the English, it was 800 pages of their oral law. All these interpretations and interpretations, traditions that they had. And then they would take them the Mishnah, and they would kind of break that down, interpret it, and try to, you know, expound on that. And then they would get their Talmud out of that. Another huge book of various volumes that kind of explain the breakdown of the Mishnah. Again, it just became an exhausting list of rules and regulations to follow. Jesus wanted to bring people back to the true intent of the law. And, you know, sadly, many today are quick to claim, you know, we're no longer under the law. We're under grace. And people can speak negatively of the law today. Jesus is looking to bring people back to the true intent of the law. He's not saying, I've come to wipe it out. He's not saying, yeah, the law, forget about the law, man. I'm here now. It's all about grace. He says, I didn't come to destroy it, but came to fulfill it. Now, the law had three categories to it. As we've gone through the book of Exodus and the book of Leviticus, we've seen this breakdown. There was, first of all, the ceremonial aspect to the law. This was their instructions regarding their worship of God, the various sacrifices and ceremonies and such. Secondly, there was the civil part of the law, and that was their instruction regarding their daily living and how they were to carry out just punishment for their crimes and wrongdoings, their civil law, their interaction with one another. But there was also the moral law. And that was their instruction regarding their relationship to God and their relationship to fellow man. And that was seen more, you know, exactly in the Ten Commandments, the moral law. You see, guys, the purpose of the law was to bring people into a right relationship with God. But the law simply showed that we were unable to do it fully in ourselves. That's what the law was for. The law in itself is not bad. The law shows God's good and perfect standard of righteousness. It says, hey, this is the way, man. But the law simply showed us we don't have it in ourselves to fulfill the law. We don't have it in ourselves to carry the law out. We can't do it. We needed one to stand in our place as that perfect righteous standard. Listen to what Galatians chapter 3, verse 24 to 26 says. Therefore, the law was a tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor, for you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. So we see, guys, that the law was to drive us to Jesus Christ. Because we realized we can't do it in ourselves. We can't get to God in our works. We need one greater. We need one that has fulfilled it. It's Jesus Christ. The law is to drive us to Jesus Christ. But now, since we've come to Jesus Christ, the law is to direct us in Him. It's to be that measuring stick again to see, how am I doing in my life with God? We don't live by the law, but the law is useful in directing us now. And directing us in Jesus. This is what David Guzik says. The law sends us to Jesus to be justified because it shows us our inability to please God in ourselves. But after we come to Jesus, He sends us back to the law to learn the heart of God for our conduct and sanctification. Though we are now living by grace, the law still is able to show us how we are doing in our relationship to Him. I mean, as I said earlier, there are many that look to disparage the law and say, we're no longer under law. It's under grace. Well, what do those people do? Those people that say that, what do they do with, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal? They say, yeah, it's good. I'm no longer under that. That's a good thing, you know, because I've been robbing a few people lately. And, well, it's, you know, it's just good that we no longer have to live by the law. No, the law still shows us God's perfect standard. But it does show us that we can't do it in ourselves. That's why Jesus came to fulfill it, as he says here. So that through him and in him, we might have acceptance to God. That we might have a leg to stand on in his presence. He came to fulfill the law because we were unable to do it. Jesus says, now the law is to direct us. And he says, not the least of the letters, he says, not one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. In other words, a jot was, you know, the smallest of the Hebrew letters. A tittle was the smallest of the pen stroke. And so he says, not the least of a, or the one jot or one tittle will by no means pass. Not the least of the letters or the smallest of pen strokes will fade away until everything is fulfilled. We don't need to look at the law and say, ah, the law. We can just skip that now. No. The law is good. But we just simply understand, I can't be right with God based on the law. I don't have it in me. I need Jesus Christ, the one who has fulfilled the law. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men, so they shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. And so Jesus says those that do them and teach them to others will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. There are many that were looking to only teach the law and have no responsibility in living it. He says that those that break the law and teach others to do so will be very insignificant in the kingdom. And then he says something very shocking. I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. This would have been a shocking saying to those there present in that day. You see, the Pharisees and the scribes, these guys were the spiritual superstars of their day. These were the equivalent of the Billy Grahams, you know, the Chuck Smiths, Chuck Swindolls. All these guys. They were the ones that people looked upon and thought, man, if I could just be like those guys, they're so righteous, they're so holy. If I could just be like them. And yet, now Jesus says your righteousness needs to exceed that of their righteousness. You see, there weren't many that could read the Hebrew text of scriptures. Hebrew was kind of beginning to be a forgotten language. And so the people relied on the Pharisees and the scribes to read the scriptures and to interpret it to them. The Pharisees consisted of a group of about 7,000 people. Their name Pharisees meant separated ones. And they were the people that were devoting themselves to the interpretation of the law. The scribes were those devoted to, you know, to the reading of the law and the application of the law as well. There was a popular saying in that day that said this: if only two people made it to heaven, one would be a Pharisee and one would be a scribe. They thought, if only two people are going to get to heaven, one's going to be a Pharisee, they're righteous, they're holy, they're interpreting the law for us and teaching it to us, the scribes are the same way. Man, if only two people are going to get to heaven, one's going to be a scribe, one will be a Pharisee. And yet now Jesus says, your righteousness needs to exceed that of their righteousness if you are going to make it into the kingdom of heaven. A weighty proposition in the eyes of his audience, no doubt. And you see, the Pharisees had made such a burden of the law. Again, it wasn't God's true intent of law. They went and made a huge burden of it. They divided the law into 613 commandments by this time. God just said 10 of them, didn't he? In Exodus 20. 10 commandments I give you. And yet now they broke it down into 613 commandments. 248 do's and 365 don'ts. And then those were broken down into various categories. Now let's take, for instance, the command, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy, and in it you shall do no work. Well, they thought, well, what constitutes work? So they dissected this command to no end. They thought, well, what constitutes work? Well, carrying a burden is a work. Well, what's a burden? And they had all these different definitions of a burden. One of them was that anything that weighed more than a dried fig, that was considered a burden. So anything that you carried that was heavier than a dried fig, that was a burden. It was work, thus you're breaking the Sabbath. I mean, this is what they were like. And so they began to teach. Listen, on the Sabbath day, if you've got a prosthetic leg, maybe you've got a fake hand, if you've got false teeth, you can't move. Because the minute you begin to walk, you're carrying a burden. You've got to take your false leg off, take your false hand off, take your false teeth out, and then you can move around because you're not carrying a burden. This is what the Pharisees were teaching. It's in the Talmud, if you don't believe me. A woman couldn't look into the mirror because if she saw a gray hair and she wanted to pluck it out, well, that would be harvesting. Can't do that. That's work. Can't do that. If you spit on the Sabbath, well, you could spit, but you have to spit on a rock because if you spit in the dirt and it began to kind of make some mud while you were plowing, that was work. Can't do that. And they began to break this all down. And, oh, this is a good one too. They had a rule that you could only travel a certain distance from your home on the Sabbath day. You couldn't go more than a certain amount of paces on the Sabbath from your home. So what the Pharisees would go and do, they would go and begin to build all these lean-tos on the side of their roadways. Certain paces from their house, they'd build one lean-to and then go a certain pace and build another lean-to. And they say, these are just kind of extensions of my home. So if they wanted to go a fair distance on the Sabbath, they would walk from their house, stop in the lean-to and say, yeah, I'm just stopping at this wing of my house and still not leaving home technically. And now we can go to the next lean-to. And that way they could cover a large distance of ground. And they had all these different rules and regulations, but yet always ways to kind of, you know, get around them too. This kind of observation to their traditions and interpretations still exists today with Orthodox Jews. In fact, back in 1992, there were three apartments in an Orthodox neighborhood in Israel that burned to the ground. Well, they asked a rabbi whether a telephone call to the fire department on the Sabbath violated Jewish law, because observant Jews are forbidden to use the phone on the Sabbath because doing so would break an electrical current, which is considered a form of work. So in the half hour that it took the rabbi to decide, yes, the fire spread to two neighboring apartments. This is the kind of bondage that they were living under. What are we able to do? What are we not able to do? Am I breaking the law? That's not what God intended. He didn't mean the Sabbath or any of the other laws to be such a heavy burden. And yet this is what the Pharisees and scribes were doing. And they were carrying out, they were living it. And so many people looked at their lives and thought, oh, these guys are righteous. They are the spiritual superstars of our day. If only I could be as holy as them. Many thought that they had it all down. Yet now they're told they need to have a righteousness beyond that of the scribes and Pharisees. You see, the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees was an external one. It was a life lived outwardly, and yet their attitudes were very corrupt. We'll see that as we go through the book of Matthew here. And Jesus is beginning to show that the kingdom way is a matter of the heart. Again, that attitude we're to have. It comes down to a matter of the heart. There needs to be a work done inwardly. And like I said, it goes back to the Beatitudes, realizing we're nothing in ourselves. We have nothing to commend us to God. We're poor in spirit, but we hunger and thirst after Christ's righteousness by which we are able to stand before God. We receive His mercy and His grace and understand it's the work of His Spirit that brings about the transformation of my heart. And so Jesus now begins to go through some of their laws and show them the true meaning of the law, God's intent to the law. And he shows that it is a matter of the heart. Let's go through this first one. Murder begins in the heart. And we'll go up to verse 26 and end there. But verse 21, you've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder. And whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Again, Jesus looked at a portion of the law that the religious leaders could follow outwardly. They were able to say, yeah, we're not murderers. We haven't murdered anybody. And they would come, they would do everything they could, but just come short of actually killing someone. Again, Jesus wants to show them what's in your heart, guys. It's the attitude of the heart that matters here. It's not carrying out the law externally. It's what's going on internally that I really am concerned about. And he begins to show now the inward standard of God's righteousness. It's not only murdering someone outwardly that can bring judgment, but it's having an anger inwardly towards another that can lead to judgment. You know, we look at murderers and think, what could ever have driven a person to do that? What could have ever made somebody go and kill someone? But the very anger that led them to carry out that act is the very anger that we battle with in our own hearts. Yeah, that might be a bit of a heavy one today. But guys, that's the kind of anger that we need to keep in check day in and day out. You see, Jesus is showing us that it's a condition of the heart that we need to look at. Many of us can look at the law and say, I've never murdered anyone. I'm doing all right. I'm keeping the law pretty good. But Jesus says, hey, what's in your heart? It's the attitude of the heart. When we have a root of hatred in our heart, we are in the same standing before God as a murderer, condemned under the law in need of a Savior. Think about that. When we allow anger to take root in our heart, God looks at that the same way as he does one that actually carries out murder outwardly. It just simply shows us we're sinners. And then he says, whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. Raca means empty head. Numbskull, nimwit. You ever called somebody that? It's a very disrespectful term in that day. It was an assault on one's intellect. And then he says, but whoever says you fool, well, they shall be in danger of hellfire. You see, calling one a fool was harsher in that it was an assault on one's character. It was basically like calling someone, you idiot. You're a real jerk. And it was just an assault on one's character. And you see, Jesus says, you shall be in danger of hellfire. That's a pretty steep warning to us. You see, who are we to cast such accusations? Are these not the people Jesus died for? Are these not the people that Jesus wants to reach with his love? And when we come into the picture with words of anger and hearts of hatred, you know, we can hinder the work of God. We are cutting them down and placing ourselves in judgment when we do that. We, in a sense, are murdering a part of them when we call them a bonehead or when we call them an idiot. When we speak judgmentally of them, we're tearing away a part of them. Maybe there'll be others that hear that and won't think of them the same way. We are killing a part of them when we use such harsh language like that. Who are we to say something like that to those people that Jesus died for, to those people that Jesus loved? And we need to realize, hey, we were a bunch of boneheads. We were a bunch of idiots until Jesus came and said, hey, I've got good news for you. I died for you, that you might have life in me. Now, there are times when we need to show a righteous anger, but again, it's anger in control. Jesus is addressing an unrighteous anger here because it's there inwardly that murderous acts are birthed outwardly. It's there in our heart where anger can begin to take root and murderous acts can begin to be birthed outwardly, can quickly get out of hand. Now, listen to what he says here in verse 23. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. You see, the Jews would bring their gifts and sacrifices as an act of worship. They'd be proclaiming God's goodness and God's forgiveness. But he says, if you come bringing that gift to the altar, that sacrifice into the temple, if you come bringing that, and there remember that your brother has something against you, maybe you've done something to your brother and you just offended him, God says, leave the gift at the altar, and go and get right with your brother. In other words, don't ask God to do for you what you're not willing to do for another. Don't come to the altar and say, God, thank you for your goodness. Thank you for your mercy. Thank you for your forgiveness in my life. I just worship you today. Don't go and ask God to forgive you if you're not willing to go and forgive your brother when you've wronged him. Or maybe when he's done something wrong against you. Go and make it right, God says. God's more interested in reconciliation than he is in a religious duty or a religious act. He says, leave your gift at the altar. Get things right with your brother first. And then come and offer your gift. It'll be much more freeing for you. So does that mean that when I come into church and I want to worship the Lord, I need to make sure that I haven't wronged anybody in my life? If that were the case, you guys would never see me again. I'd be spending the rest of my life trying to make everything right with everybody that I've wronged, everybody that I've done something bad to. I'd be spending the rest of my days going, oh, you know, I got to track this brother down. Forgive me. You know, now I got to get to this next guy. And, oh, I'm only on number two of, you know, 538 million, you know, people that I've wronged. Man. No, Jesus says, when you come, and there, remember. I think that's the key for us. When you come into my presence, and there, remember. In other words, when it's something that comes to mind, maybe the Lord is putting that on your heart to say, hey, get this right first. In other words, be led of the Lord here. Because we can come to the Lord and go, man, I'm just angry at this person, or I'm upset at that person, or realize maybe that person's upset at me. Well, too bad for them, man. They better just deal with it. When we remember those things, go and make it right first. We don't need to go and backtrack with every person we've wronged. But when the Lord puts that on your heart and brings that to mind, man, make it right. And you'll be blessed for it. You'll be freed up through it. And then he says, agree with your adversary quickly, with your adversary quickly, while you are on the way with him. Lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. You see, in this day, the plaintiff, if somebody had something, you know, wrong with you or against you, that plaintiff would have to go and track down the defendant personally and take him to the courts. So if somebody had wronged me and I was just mad at that person, I'd have to go and track that person down and say, hey, let's go, buddy. We're going to the courts, you know. We're going to deal with this now once and for all. And they'd be on the road together. I mean, imagine that trip. That would be real kind of awkward, wouldn't it, you know. So, you know, how's your day going today? Or, you know, I mean, that'd be pretty silent there, I think. Very uncomfortably awkward. But Jesus says, while you're on the road with your adversary, make a deal, man. Make a deal. Cut a deal with them. In other words, reconcile the situation. Be quick to apologize for your own good. Because if you are stubborn and dragging your feet, you may be the one that ends up in prison. And you will be there until you pay the last penny. But here's the pickle. If you're put in prison, how are you going to work? How are you going to make money? How are you going to be able to pay the last penny if you're imprisoned? You're going to be stuck. You're going to be in prison for an awfully long time. Guys, that's a real good lesson for us today. Because many people have allowed anger to get the better of them. They have refused to be humble and apologetic. They have fought their case and they've been very unforgiving. And the only problem is that their anger now has imprisoned them. They've come to a place of being trapped, unable to live the life of freedom and joy, the life of blessing and happiness. They've been imprisoned by their own anger. Jesus says it's not just about murder outwardly, it's the condition of the heart inwardly, guys. Anger will lead to danger. Danger is the word anger with just D added to it. D-Day. Man, when you struggle with anger, beware, because D-Day is going to come. You're going to find yourself in danger when you allow anger to begin to take root in your heart. Keeping the law is not just an external thing, it's an internal thing. And we see that we are guilty of breaking the law. But this is what Jesus wants people to see. We're guilty, but he is gracious. We are sinners, but he is a savior. The heart of the law is to lead us to Jesus, because he has perfectly fulfilled the law that we might be justified through him. Guys, today, we're not bound by the law. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that we're trying to follow the law. But the law is good, because it shows us where we're at in our relationship to God. And we realize that the law is not just an external list of do's and don'ts. Jesus says, it's a matter of the heart. That's the kingdom way. What's in your heart, guys? Because what's in your heart will ultimately begin to manifest itself and show itself in outward ways. It's a condition of the heart, and deal with the heart. And Jesus is in the business of heart surgery, guys. He's in the business of transforming us, and we need the power of his Spirit in our lives so that we can live for him, so that we can have hearts that are pure unto him. Let's make that our prayer today.